Webster's defines atypical as not like the usual normal type. Well, welcome to the Atypical Podcast from theatypicallife.com. I am Matt Mooney.
And I'm Jenny Mooney. Here, we take a look at all kinds of things.
We may tell stories, we call them side stories, welcome a friend to join us, or interview someone more widely known and ask them all kinds of questions. And sometimes, yes, sometimes we may just do a little Matt chat, discussing the current happenings of our life.
Through all of it, we hope to give you something atypical as you listen along your typical day.
Today, Jenny and I sat down to talk with Kyle Strobel. Kyle is a professor of spiritual theology and formation at Talbot School of Theology. He lives in Southern California with his wife, Kelly, and their two children. And he is the recent co-author of the book, The Way of the Dragon, or The Way of the Lamb. Subtitle is Searching for Jesus' Path of Power in a Church That Has Abandoned It. Hey, Kyle. We are excited to talk to you today because you wrote or co-authored the book, The Way of the Dragon or The Way of the Lamb. Actually, a book that we have talked about a few times already on the podcast and promised people before we knew we would be able to that we would have you on.
So, we did.
So we're actually excited to deliver on that.
Yeah.
I'm glad I could help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jenny and I both, and we rarely do this, but we read through a book together. Now, oftentimes we, you know, do the good Christian couple thing and pretend like we're going to read a book together.
Yep. And then we never do.
Yeah. Let's, for instance, we have a book on our shelf right now. We won't mention it, but we didn't.
Oh, I thought you were going to.
Well, I don't want to say, and we didn't read it.
Well, just yet.
Sometimes we read at different speeds. And then Jenny reads a paragraph and really delves deep on it or falls asleep.
Yep. Yep, that's more my style of reading. But with this one, a friend of ours actually texted us a picture of the cover and said, and I'm not sure if you know Seth and Amber Haynes, but they're friends of ours and they have, you know, been on this podcast with us before. And she texted us a picture and said, both of you. She didn't send it just to me. She added Matt in on this text thread and she said, both of you, read this book. And like, that doesn't come from her very often. So we were like, okay. And my thing was I did not, or I didn't do that thing where it's like, oh, we're going to order one and share it. Real cute. Nope. We ordered two separate books.
It's not the way we roll, Kyle. So if you're not Matt and Jenny Mooney and you haven't read the book and you're not a believer, what I would love for you to do just at the outset is to lay out for us an overview of the book and just kind of what its message is for believers in the broad church.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is kind of a very unusual book for Jamin and I. Jamin and I have both written together before. I've written before. And, you know, this one was about a 6 or 7 year long journey for us. And we really felt that we were called to write a book on the way of Christian power. And so initially the thought was, well, let's try to give an account of what does Jesus's way of power look like in the world today. And of course, that's going to be power in weakness. And so we'll have to figure out, you know, how do we talk about that? What does that actually mean? You know, we have those key verses that pop up but what does that look like? You know, what does that mean? And, you know, very early on in this project, we realized, you know, when we started it, we were kind of young 30s. And we're like, we can't write this book. That's nuts. Why would a young 30-something girl know something about power and weakness? It just didn't strike us as that was the wisest thing to do. And so what we did is we went around, in many cases, the world, interviewing people for this that we thought embodied Jesus's way of power, not just you know, for a couple of years or not just once, but over decades and decades of faithfulness. And so we interviewed folks like J.I. Packer, like Dallas Willard, like John Perkins and Jean Vanier and Marva Dawn, Eugene Peterson, and someone like James Houston, who is a kind of mentor of ours. And then as we sat with them over a several year period in different times and for different lengths of time, we realized there were some other issues that we were forced into that, to be honest, we weren't interested in getting into all that much, and we certainly weren't planning on getting into. In particular, the Marva interview with Marva Dawn, who's delightful and brilliant, and she really pushed us to think about the nature of not only power, but the powers. And so Paul talks about the powers and the principalities of the world. And so we struggled to give an account of how do we think about the nature of these powers well? How do we understand what it means to have power and weakness against the powers and the principalities of this world? And so ultimately the book turned into a kind of wholesale account of what does it look like in our day and age to embrace not the way of the world, the flesh, and the demonic, as James 3 will say, but the way of Jesus.
And, you know, it was really interesting. It did actually sound like you guys kind of went on a journey. So the beginning of the book kind of, to me, reads a little bit different than the end of the book and where you've kind of ended up. And you do.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think that was most certainly affected by the list of people that you got to. And I got to say, like, what a genius way to do a book just so you get to sit down with all these folks, because I love this list of people. And we'll talk about Jean Vanier, somebody dear to our hearts, and Eugene Peterson. And so it was fun to be introduced to some folks that I wasn't as familiar with, but some folks who we already deeply loved. And so as you, Kyle, as you went on this journey, as you begin to learn, as you sit down with these folks, what were you surprised by? And what was it that you were learning that kind of caught you off guard?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there was a lots of things that we did expect, in part because we knew the work of these folks so well. I mean, everyone we chose had been a mentor, if by nothing else through their writing. Several of them had been mentors of ours in general, but there's a couple things that we just didn't even think about. You know, one of the, when we sat down after all of this was over and just kind of thought about our experience and being with these people and the things we learned, and what struck us is, you know, these people have very little in common at the end of the day. They do very different ministries. Many of them are in widely different theological contexts. Many different, you know, some are academics, some are pastors, some are working with folks with disabilities. There's all sorts of things. And yet they all kind of radiated with joy. Mm. And one of the things that struck us as interesting is, you know, we were writing a hard book because we knew we were going to have to say some really difficult things. We were going to have to name evil and name it in the church. And what was interesting for us is that none of these people shied away from that, but none of them lost hope either. And what we saw were people who had been formed after decades of faithfulness with a certain abiding hopefulness in the church, not because the church herself is faithful, but because Christ has been so faithful to the church and will continue to be so. And so they were, you know, in particularly today, I mean, I think it's hard to find people who can both name evil in the church and do it with love and do it with hopefulness and do it with care. Typically, I find people that either refuse to name evil in the church because it feels unfaithful, or people who are very willing to do it but do so out of anger and do so with a sense of hopelessness and do so with a sense of almost maybe revenge. And that really struck us as profound, that these folks were able to see things as they really were. They didn't feel the sense they had to romanticize any of this. And yet they could, in that honesty, not lose any hope and not lose any of their joy and simply trust in the fact that the Lord's faithful.
Man, you know, that what's interesting about that is I'd actually written in my notes for talking to you today, like this idea that I saw a lot when you were talking about Marva or talking with Marva Dawn. Mm-hmm. And that is just calling out very, you know, specific things culturally that are evil. And it's almost like it's almost shocking a little bit. Like, I think when I read it, I'm just not used to hearing that. I think people kind of tiptoe around it, but there was such an honesty in the things you were talking about without judgment. And I was so challenged in that because I just thought, I do not have that in my life. I have either or, you know, like, and so sure. to have that you know, discussion was really powerful to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kyle. And I think you guys, I think the tension that you describe is very evident in the book, in that you are kind of turning the spotlight onto the church and to, I think, the ways of the world that can seep into the church. And what did that, you know, explain to me just kind of that tension. And, you know, what did, you know, I would imagine that this isn't going to probably be your best-selling book. Maybe I'm wrong, you know, but like, like just the entire publishing industry of Christian publishing is set up around, you know, build your platform, be successful, pretty much the ways of the world. And here you are, you know, you pop onto the screen with a, well, we got this philosophy of weakness, you know, and I'm sure every publisher wanted to just chomp it at the bit to get this.
Well, even like, I mean, I've even had someone look at the glance at it on my counter and read the subtitle, which says "Searching for Jesus's Path of Power in a Church That Has Abandoned It," and they went, "Whoa." Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, we're not messing around with that one.
Describe to me just that tension and what has been the reaction that you've received.
Yeah, you know, throughout the process, there were several points, you know, and one of the advantages I think Jamin and I had is we did kind of wrestle with this over, you know, 6-7 years. And that was very purposeful. So this book was a part of a 2-book contract. So this is the second book. So this is actually a follow-up book to our previous book, Beloved Dust. And so Jamin and I, we've written together before. This is not our first kind of publishing kind of venture. And we're aware of the temptations in publishing. And so we would have frequent conversations as we wrote saying, okay, I'm tempted to do this now. I'm tempted to shy away from naming this because I think it's going to hurt us. Because people might hear it this way, or you know, you start second guessing some of this stuff. You start wondering, is this sellable? And over again, Jamin and I realized no, like. There's two things we felt very clear about. We have to name it, but we have to name it in ourselves first. And that really became kind of axiomatic for us, is that the only way we can honestly name evil in the church is to name how tempted we are towards that same evil. And, you know, when we're naming pastors who give in to grandiosity, who give in to, you know, cheating the New York Times bestseller list to try to sell the book, I get that. Like I could walk you through the kind of steps a person would be tempted by in order to justify that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've got to know that in myself first so I can actually respond. I need to name it, but I need to be able to recognize in myself I could have done that. And so that really became for us the key way to engage that tension is we have to be able to recognize this in ourselves first and foremost, and we have to balance out, you know, we could have recognized it in ourselves personally, but then every story we tell was kind of evil in the church or evil in, you know, and we said no, we actually have to name our own struggles in the book. And actually we hope people are more confronted with that reality, even that here are people who see this temptation primarily in themselves, and that's how they recognize it in the church. That was kind of our goal.
And as we just continue with this theme of like juxtaposing the way of the dragon and the way of the lamb and helping people who have not read the book yet, what do you think, explain to me from the philosophy of the book, what would be like the potential typical mindset of a young church pastor ready to get in there and he's ready to go. But you would say kind of, whoa, there's some dangerous creep of the way of the world instead of the way of the weakness into you. Can you just kind of orient us to kind of what it is we're talking about still?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the passages that really became kind of axiomatic for us was James 3. And in James, we have two ways presented to us, just like the dragon or the lamb. And it's the way from above, which is the way of Jesus, and the way from below. And James says these are the way – the way from below is unspiritual, it's earthly, and it's demonic. And those three categories the church has, you know, for quite a long time now, taken up as the three spheres of evil, as the way of the world, the flesh, and the devil. And what struck us is that – so here are three intercombined realities that are all interlocked. And what holds them together is actually a power system, a power structure. And what's interesting about James 3, I mean, we're talking about the way of the demonic. So this is kind of gnarly, right? This is not mild. You know, this is serious stuff. But the attributes he lists there are jealousy and selfish ambition. And it was in our interview with Marva Dawn when she pointed out that if you want to see selfish ambition and jealousy, just go to a pastor's conference. And that is a harsh reality to be confronted with. And I would add, you know, I'm a professor, so I live in the world of the academy. And I could add it very easily. Just go to any academic conference if you want to see jealousy and selfish ambition reign. And so, you know, for a lot of young pastors, even my seminary students, you know, a lot of them are there for the same reasons Jamin and I were there very early on. It's grandiosity, right? Mm. It's a desire to be great, is jealous of what other people have, the position of authority, the platform, the power, you know, whatever it is. And that's not to say there's not a genuine call wrapped up in that stuff, but it's to name the reality of you can easily do ministry in this way. To use Paul's language from Galatians 6, you can sow ministry in the flesh. But if you do, you will reap in the flesh. And so I think for a lot of young pastors, the temptation will be to have good motivation or to have good kind of goals and to use kind of systems of the world to try to achieve those goals and to think that that somehow is going to reap spiritual fruit when the scriptures are clear. No, that is sowing in the flesh and you will reap in the flesh.
Kyle, I love that description, and thanks for that. Do you think that at the particular moment in time where we sit as a culture and as a church, you know, when you read James 3, this is not a new temptation. This is not a new juxtaposition. But do you think, in particular, in the time that we sit, that this is a higher temptation, a more likely temptation? Is it technology and social media gives us all the opportunity to have a platform and a voice and chase after followers and likes and thumbs ups? And what's your sense of the pulse of just kind of the timing of where we are in this temptation?
Yeah, no, I do think it's interesting. I mean, it's, you know, in many ways, it's a, you know, our book, I've actually been encouraged about how well received this book has been. Because I kind of expected it would just get rejected altogether because it was just so totally contrary to where our culture currently is. But I think what's been interesting is people have shown a real awareness of this problem recently. And I think in the last couple of years with all the things that have gone on in our country, socially, politically. I mean, there's the time is ripe, I think, for a conversation about power. But I think the problem is, yeah, I mean, the way our, you know, technology itself's never bad. I mean, even books are technology. But when you get to modern technologies and you get to the rise of not just, you know, things like internet use, things like video games, and then of course the vices of kind of things like pornography, and you know, it's what's been interesting is how many studies are now coming out about what these things do to the brain, and how because of the plasticity of our brain, people are losing the ability to actually kind of enter into things that are slow moving, things that don't give them constant excitement, constant arousal, constant change, you know, and when we're formed in that way, Christianity won't make any sense to us and relationships won't make any sense to us. And we live in a culture where our as you kind of mentioned, you know, with social media, with even things as simple as the rise of Amazon and the rise of self-publishing. Like, in many ways, those things are benign. Like, there's nothing particularly kind of nefarious about them. But if you think of 40 years ago, if you wanted to be a Christian author, you didn't have to have a great platform. You didn't have to be on the road speaking everywhere. You needed to be trusted and you needed to be faithful. And publishers needed to believe that your message needed to be heard. And then people who ran bookstores needed to be able to read your book and say, wow, here is someone that the church needs to hear. And so there were these structures in place of both authority and accountability. Now those structures are entirely gone. And so now it's simply down to what is sellable, who has the ability to sell things, who has, and I think the rise of Amazon really ended up flattening out a structure that was there to actually create accountability. And in our day and age, we have to, I mean, I think churches really need to think about this, and denominations really need to think about how do we consider who has the voice in our people's lives and how do we help speak into that? I mean, I don't think we necessarily restrict it, but how do we speak into it? And I think a lot of it ends up forcing us into ways of life, particularly for those of us who are doing things like publishing, where we embody worldly and oftentimes very fleshly ways to try to kind of live in this industry. And ultimately that will destroy it. It'll just kind of warp it from the inside.
Well, Kyle, as you talk about moving into a slow moving world and our the changes in technology and the changes in the world that make that a little more difficult, as you talk about relationships and the power of and importance of relationships, as you talk about weakness, we're really now getting to the part of the interview that we are most excited about, but we didn't want to just pigeonhole it to that. But that is just that you, for us, in our experience of being in community with persons with disability and through our work with 99 Balloons, I think you have to, the message contained in this book for us was such a message that we feel like God has been teaching us for the last decade since he ushered us into this world. Not anything that was natural to us, but more of himself in slow relationships and in weakness. And so I just wanted to ask you about your time with Jean Vanier, someone that we love from afar, admire and read. Can you just talk about just specifically about your time with him and what you felt, what you felt he has to say to the church today?
Yeah, you know, Jean is one of the most profound human beings I've ever met. And, you know, one of the things I loved about him and I still love about him is that he has no tendency to romanticize what it means to minister to people who struggle with disabilities, particularly radical disabilities. And so he'll often tell stories about, you know, interns or people who come to volunteer because they read one of his books or often read a Henry Nouwen book or something like that. And when they get, and they have this totally romanticized vision of what this looks like. And he'll say that, you know, when you're ministering to someone who can only scream, it will awaken a scream inside your heart. And, you know, one of the things that Vanier, I think, understands so well, and this is another very interesting kind of overlap with everyone that we interviewed, was the recognition that if we're going to stand against the powers and the principalities of this world, and for Vanier, that was standing against the dehumanizing institutionalization of folks with disability. That if we're going to stand against this, we have to be prepared to be confronted with our own anger, with our own dehumanization, with our own desire to silence these screams as well, and with our own inability to enter into the simple and profound way of weakness. And I think what I think Jean teaches so well is that, you know, in a world that where, and I think this is particularly true about America in a way that isn't true about most countries, actually. You know, and it's only America where if you run into someone at a coffee shop and meet for the first time, one of the first questions you ask someone is, what do you do? You don't do that in Canada. You don't do that in Britain. You just complain about the weather, right? That's what you do. And then eventually you get around to talking about what do you do? That's a distinctively American thing. And as James Houston, who we interviewed about this as well, who was talking specifically about the elderly, saying, what happens when you no longer do? The implication is you're not fully human. And I think as a culture, we've come to define ourselves, our identity, our value based on these things we can achieve either actually or potentially. And therefore, then when we're confronted with someone with disabilities who might not be able to do, and we kind of presuppose that they actually don't have something to offer. And what Vanier shows us is that's quite the opposite, in fact. Because their disability, they're actually more attuned to what weakness is like, what it means to need another, what it needs to call out for love, what that means and what that entails. And if you give yourself to someone like this, you slowly become tuned to that different pace, a value system that is not based on our own internal resources, but is based on love that is given and received. And I think that notion, which is so central to the gospel, but so often missed in our culture, Vanier kind of shows, and I think his whole life really proves Jesus's point. You know, for Christians, our goal isn't weakness. Our goal is still power, but it's only power that is discovered in weakness. And Vanier is a powerful man. If you've ever heard him, you can YouTube him. You know, if you read his books, there's no question. Like, this is a powerful human being. But he didn't become powerful through worldly channels. Right? It wasn't that he didn't just become savvy. He didn't just learn techniques to, convince people he was right and make friends and influence people. Or, you know, he didn't do that. Right? He gave himself to people no one else was caring about. And by giving himself to them profoundly, he was formed very deeply. And I think the message that the church needs to really reconsider today is that maybe our desire to be impactful in this world is itself a kind of idolatry.
Well, I want to just rewind everything you just said, and we're going to just listen back to it over and over and over. And that, I mean, that is really our heartbeat, and that's what we've learned. And it is not, it's not been romantic. You know, we have a daughter who we did a lot of head nodding on the screen.
I mean, there's some tears over here.
we were quiet on purpose. But that is, Kyle, that really has been the road that we've walked down, and we have found a friend in that, in Vanier's writing and just his way of living. And Jenny, I know you have some comments or some questions.
Well,
on that.
First of all, I feel like I've really matured in podcasting because it was all I could do to not interrupt every 2 seconds for like a whoop and a holler
this
and a clapping.
This has not come easy, Kyle. This has not come easy. I have coached her up.
But I mean, I think as I hear you speak, it's the same thing I felt when I read lots of the book, but specifically the chapter six, which is titled Unexpected Power. So just to catch you and maybe some listeners up, as a 26-year-old first-time mother, I gave birth to a son who was very sick and who we knew his days were numbered. And by the world's standard, you know, he had one smaller ear than the other. His hands overlapped. He had a weaker lung. I mean, there were all these things about him that would be considered super weak and, you know, not what the world deems as valuable. But we beheld him in this, like, really, it was a short amount of time, but the Lord almost expanded it in our hearts and minds because we had, you know, we didn't know if the next day was promised. So we just kind of beheld this child. And I don't know. I mean, I'd never truly experienced glory and weakness like I did in those 99 days. And so when I read chapter six, or I hear you describe what you just described, I mean, I can like I literally get like my heart beats faster because I don't necessarily articulate what I've experienced as well as that, or definitely as Vignette. But when I read his words or read your experience with him through y'all's book and then hear you speak, I mean, it's hard to process because someone has put language to the things that God has given us that have been terrible pain and terrible joy, but all found in that weakness.
And I think, Kyle, you know, for us and through our organization, the work we get to do, we get to work with churches, and I often say that, you know, we get to work with the best churches because we're working with churches who really want to walk toward this. But so many of our churches, as is true of every chapter of your book, you know, they just kind of stiff arm the realities of this kingdom, and they you know, you see the light kind of not on in their eyes when you're talking about these kind of things. And I think for us, I have tremendous grace and mercy for that, because I can back up to me before Elliot, you know, and had you asked me to come and work with a person with disability or spend some time with them, I would have said, you know, where do I write a check for that? That sounds like great work that I am scared to death of. And yet, you know, God has shown us so much more of himself through the places we would have otherwise avoided. Because, you know, who walks toward weakness? You know, but for Jesus, none of us walk toward weakness. And so I love that message. And it has done our hearts good to see that message carried on and to see that message put down really well in your book. So thank you for taking the 6 to 7 year journey of being faithful to write it. I know it wasn't easy. And I'm super encouraged actually to hear and not completely surprised to hear that it's been well received. So,
we've been encouraged by that. Yeah. Because we just genuinely didn't know.
No, I'm sure you had some awkward looks as you pitched this book.
Well, I mean, we'll joke sometimes and say that's a little too truthy. I mean, that makes me a little, and there's a lot of that in this book. And I love that though.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, Kyle, if you could set a, you know, if you could set the church down and the church was represented in a person that could sit across from you. And from this 6 to 7 year journey, what would you really hone in on? And at the particular moment in time that we've talked about, that we set as a culture, and all of these discussions rage on race, on gender identity, on where the church stands, on who gets the authority to speak, and you know, all of these things have such a, they have, for some reason right now, I feel like there's just such a just an anger tone to them. And I love that the folks that you interviewed, you know, seem to kind of have that balance of very passionate, very much believing and being able to name the things. And yet you describe them as full of joy. How do you think that we, at the time that we're in, live in that tension of calling out evil when we see evil within the church, but also living the grace and the mercy, and not just the truth as well?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I think hit Jamin and I, because Jamin and I sat down right before the book came out, and we really wrestled through, how do we want to promote a book like this? Mm. We've always been uncomfortable with promotion. We've always been unclear on what it looks like, and as we've already talked about, the publishing industry, I mean, it's a very murky kind of place. And the expectation to just kind of constantly be kind of selling your wares wherever you go. And, you know, Jamin and I, we really thought, kind of sat down and prayed kind of long and hard about, Lord, what are you calling us to in all of this? And what struck me is that, you know, I don't need to convince people I'm right about this, that actually isn't my call. The call, and it's not even to sit down and try to get people to read my book. The goal for us has been, we need to convince the church that this is a conversation we have to have. And the problem with power is, if you don't talk about it, you will be driven by a false form of it. And it's a conversation that simply is not being had. I mean, that's one of the things that shocked us as we really sat down with the literature and tried to look around, like, who's talking about this? No one's talking about this in the church. And yet it fuels everything we do. Every ministry, every church service, every outreach event, all of it is fueled by our vision of power. And if we're not talking about that, I think that's where we get some of this animosity towards one another. We get some, because when you're not confronted with your own temptation to use worldly power, you often see it in others very clearly. And so if we're going to sit down and talk about power, what's going to happen is we're all going to be very confronted by, yeah, I'm trying to use my platform to shut down voices, actually, rather than listen to them. I'm using my agenda to manipulate and drive through something I want to get done. And quite honestly, I don't care about the consequences. I'm actually employing division because I think it'll further my agenda. You know, there's all sorts of things going on. But if we really attend to what is the Jesus way of power, that maybe it's not up to me to drive this thing through. Maybe it's not up to me. Maybe it's not my job to determine who speaks and who doesn't. Maybe, you know, and so it's a recognition that somehow the kingdom isn't resting on my ability to get things done. But it's much more resting on a people who, as Paul realized, must discover that the power of God is only known in our weakness.
And that, my friends, is an atypical message for the church today that we were excited to share with you because we were excited as we went through it ourselves together in the book, The Way of the Dragon or The Way of the Lamb. If you enjoyed our conversation today with Kyle, and we hope that you did, take it viral, share it with your mother, maybe pin her a little letter and actually put a stamp on it if she's not on the social media. Share it out there in your social circles. Just make it go wildfire. We really enjoyed this one and enjoyed putting it together. Thank you for enjoying it with us, and we hope that you did. As always, you can find show notes and links at theatypicallife.com. If by chance it didn't float your boat, it didn't meet your wants, needs, and desires, please call our 1-800 number and let us know what we can do for you. Have a great week. We love you.